This is the Garden DC Podcast, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener Magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. Welcome to episode 186 of the Garden DC Podcast. In this episode, we talk with Rish Gala about planting your vegetable garden. The plant profile is on oxalis, and we share what's going on in the garden, as well as some upcoming local gardening events and this week's garden tasks in the What's New segment. We close out with the last word on My Failing Peach Tree by Christy Page of Green Prince. This episode, we're joined by Rish Gala. She is the author of Vegetable Gardening Made Easy, Simple Tips and Tricks to Grow Your Best Garden Ever. Welcome, Rish.
Thank you so much for having me, Kathy. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you on, and we're going to talk all about vegetable garden planning for all those beginning and experienced gardeners who want to figure out the best way to grow this season and the best way to lay out their plots and get them ready for spring and summer planting. But before we go into all of that, let's talk about baby Rish and say, were you born with chlorophyll in your veins and a green thumb?
Well, I wish I was. I do love spinach for sure, and I could be a cousin of Popeye potentially, but no, I was not born with a green thumb. I am a self-taught gardener. And I have whatever experience I have in gardening has been learned through experience of doing and being in the garden and trying different things and techniques. I don't have a family or a grandfather who was, you know, in love with gardening and taught me all of that. So basically, it's just I consider myself to be another average gardener, somebody who just tried gardening, failed at it for the first time, but persisted and then became successful.
I think that's the best way to learn is by experience.
I totally agree. And especially something like gardening, you have to be out there willing to be in nature, enjoy yourself, not be afraid of failure. Which I think is also so important in everything in life, right? That we don't hesitate to experiment. And I think gardeners are a true testament of that they would try everything.
Amen. And so you're being a little modest. I have to let our listeners know that you were named Burpee Home Gardens 2020 Gardener of the Year. What does all that involve?
Yes. So it is so interesting. My gardening journey, I would say it basically started with failure, like I'd mentioned before. About 6 years ago, I just went to one of those big box retailers, big box stores. And, you know, like in spring, for most gardeners, you see the racks and racks of seedlings and vegetables out there on display. And so I got tempted and I said, you know what, I'm just going to go and pick up two tomato plants and just try and grow it. And at that point, I had zero experience, didn't know anything about gardening. I got those plants. I didn't even take them out of the small pots and put them in larger containers. I grew them on my shaded patio, on my deck, so it didn't get full sunlight. And then I ended up with just two tomatoes, which had, you know, those black spots at the bottom, which is blossom end rot. And I was so disappointed. I said, you know, I'm a Jersey girl. And Rutgers tomatoes and Jersey tomatoes are so famous and were considered the garden state. So how is it possible that I'm not able to grow even two good tomatoes? So that is how my journey started with a failure. The next year, I hired a landscaper and got him to construct four small raised beds for me. But unfortunately, he filled it with, you know, soil, probably from a construction yard. It had like stones. It was very poor quality. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, I persisted, didn't give up. And I kept researching as much as possible, reading all the books and trying to consume as much of information as possible. And what I understood was really the key to success with vegetable gardening is the soil. So I started the first step actually in my gardening journey that changed me. I mean, that basically transformed my garden from failure to success was to actually start composting and making my own compost at home from my kitchen scraps. So once I started making some compost, I added that and amended my raised beds. It was like an overnight change. The plants started thriving, everything started growing. And getting back to your question about Burpee, in December of 2019, they selected me as their 2020 Gardener of the Year because one of my friends on Instagram, who must, I haven't met her yet, but she had been seeing my posts about my gardening journey and she nominated me for this. And I got an email and I got contacted by Burpee saying, hey, we've selected you as a 2020 Gardener of the Year, and we'll be sending you these new varieties that nobody has tried before for you to test out in your garden. So I was, to be honest, I was so blown away and I was so humbled by that because sometimes you don't see the potential in yourself until somebody else sees it in you. And so that made me realize that, you know what, maybe I was onto something with gardening and that I was inspiring other people as well. So 2020 COVID happened and everybody, I guess, took to gardening. And so I started getting so many questions from people about gardening. And of course, I redid some of my raised beds because we were all at home and had nothing more important to do as such. So I really focused and honed in on gardening on my social media, sharing a lot of tips and tricks, and sort of grew from there. And here I am today. I have a business that where we design and install edible organic gardens for clients in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and parts of New York. I also, share a lot of my tips and tricks on social media on my Instagram handle at Resh Gala. And apart from that, I now have this book, Vegetable Gardening Made Easy. So I feel truly blessed and humbled that this is how everything happened to be.
Such a wonderful journey, Rish. And the name of your company is 100 Tomatoes LLC. That's your kitchen garden design and install and maintenance as well.
Yes. So it's an ode to my tomato journey, so to speak, that I failed to grow the tomatoes, and also the fact that tomatoes are my most favorite thing to grow in the garden. So I named my company 100 Tomatoes, that I went from 0 to 100.
Great name. And so,
Thank
as
you.
a Jersey girl, and you mentioned the Garden State, let's talk a little bit for listeners who might be outside of the country or not in the Mid-Atlantic area about your growing conditions, your soil, your climate there.
Absolutely. So our native soil in New Jersey is definitely not perfect. It's very heavy clay soil, so it's hard for the roots to grow easily in them. And so what I like to do is I like to grow in raised beds just because right off the bat, you don't have to wait a couple of years for your soil to be amended and loamy and fluffy and loose. But you can just fill your raised beds with the best soil that you can possibly get, best organic soil, and you can start growing right away. So in New Jersey, our climate, typically, I think up until a couple of months ago, we were considered to be zone 6B. But now the new USDA regulations have said that we are now a zone 7 because of the global warming, et cetera. So we do get snow. Our growing season is typically my last frost to my first frost date is between mid-May to mid-October, which is approximately 5 months of growing the summer veggies. However, if you're like me, you like to experiment, you like to push the boundaries of what's possible, then I do a lot of season extension techniques where I cover my raised beds, which are outside in my backyard, with hoops and farm-grade plastic, et cetera. And I do grow almost, 10 months of the year, not 5 months. So yes, I'm in New Jersey and we do get snow and temperatures which go as low as single digit Fahrenheit.
Yeah, and so you have pretty good growing conditions. It's a moderate climate. You're not going to
Yes.
get an earthquake, say, coming up. But we do have
Hope
all
not.
four, yeah, all four seasons are present.
Yes.
And so let's talk a little bit about what you like to grow for yourself in your own plot and where you're growing.
Sure. So I like to grow for myself depending on the season. And this is advice that I like to give all beginner gardeners is that for success, the two most important things, one is the soil, and the second is to grow according to the season. So if I'm going to be planting something in spring, like we have spring coming up right now, or even in the cool season of fall, then the vegetables that I love to grow are kale, Swiss chard, carrots, beetroot, broccoli, bok choy, lettuce, arugula. So those are my favorites for the cool season. I also absolutely love sugar snap peas because they don't even come into our kitchen because we just eat them up straight in the garden itself. And a lot of herbs like cilantro, parsley, dill grow fantastically well in the cool season of spring and fall. When it comes to summer, my favorite, of course, is growing tomatoes. And I just can't help myself, but I tend to overplant them a little bit, too much. But I do love cucumbers, eggplants, peppers, melons, as well as ground cherries, which are my absolute favorite, Aunt Molly's ground cherries. So if nobody's tried that, highly, highly recommend that.
Yeah, I love the ground cherries too, and they're a tomatillo relative a little bit, but they kind of have that sweet pineapple taste to them.
100%, so tropical and delicious. I love them. They're my favorite.
Do you have a particular tomato variety that's your favorite?
Yes, so I actually it's hard to just say one, but I do love Aunt Ruby's German green tomatoes. I know typically people would think a green tomato would be really sour and wouldn't taste that good, but this one never turns red, and it's ripe and ready when you just squeeze it gently, and it has a little bit of give to it, but it's so sweet, so delicious, and has so many complex flavors. It's absolutely one of my favorite tomatoes to grow. I also do love the Cherokee purple because the tomatoes with the dark red, almost purplish skins, they have a beautiful smoky flavor to them. And of course, I love San Marzanos as well, just so I can make a lot of sauce and pasta sauce and things like that with it.
Yeah, I love Cherokee Purple as well. And so you're growing in a community garden plot and in your home garden, or just at the community garden plot?
So I'm growing in both these places. So I have a very small backyard. My total growing space with my raised beds in them is about 84 square feet in my backyard. But if you've seen pictures of my garden, which is on the cover of my book, as well as on my Instagram, you can tell that I really love to pack in the plants and grow a lot of variety. So I'm growing in my backyard, and I do also grow a lot of food at Duke Farms Community Garden, which is a nonprofit allotment style community garden here. And it is actually one of the largest allotment style community gardens in North America. And they're a wildlife habitat, and we grow organically there. And what I just love about that is, number one, you get to meet so many different gardeners and get a lot of experience from them and learning how they grow as well. But they also have these little plots set up called Giving Gardens, where you can volunteer your time, and the produce that you grow over there gets donated to homeless shelters, to people in need, to food pantries and food banks in New Jersey. So I think that's really, really special because a lot of people just tend to donate canned goods. And so when communities like ours do offer fresh produce, I think that's so valuable.
I agree. I think having fresh food access, especially for those food pantries and soup kitchens in the area, is so important. And I think there's a lot of disconnect between home gardeners not knowing that they can donate at those places.
Yes, exactly. They can donate and they should reach out. And when you have a lot, which sometimes, when you start your garden, you don't know how much you're going to grow. But come, peak summer, July, August, and you're flush with a lot of tomatoes, don't know what to do, I do recommend that you do share with your friends, with your family, with the community, because honestly, gardening is one of those things that brings the community together. Food is a common language, right? That links us all together. So, yeah, I highly recommend that people share as much as possible.
So if we're looking at setting up our first vegetable garden, or maybe we've purchased a home and there was a vegetable garden plot that kind of went to seed or something, and we're reclaiming that, what should be some of our first considerations?
So setting up your first garden, the first, most important thing is really sunlight, because sunlight is absolutely crucial for success with gardening. Now, there are a lot of plants that you can grow if you have shade, or you live in a town home or in an apartment, say in New York City, and can only grow on your deck or patio. So you can easily grow things like herbs and leafy greens like lettuce, arugula. And those will survive just fine. However, if you want your fruiting crops, which means your tomatoes, cucumbers, melons, etc., then it's important to get at least 6 to 8 hours of sunlight minimum, I would say. So when you know, right before you set up your garden, the most important thing is to observe your space. So that's what I suggest in my book as well, is observe your space, be aware of which spot gets the maximum sunlight. Is your plot on a slope, perhaps? So you have to have those considerations as well. And apart from the sunniest spot, I do like to also, you know, have good access and easy access to water, because a lot of people, like I design gardens for my clients, and a lot of them, they have, you know, they live in suburbia and they have acres of land and they just want to place their garden in the middle of nowhere. And I'm like, that's a bad idea, because you want your garden, your vegetable garden, to be as close to your home, to your kitchen as possible, so you can actually use it, because, you know, out of sight can be out of mind. So make sure that it's close to your home, so it's easily accessible. It shouldn't be too far away from the water. So go outside, observe your space, and also find the spot, you know, where are your sprinklers, or where's your source of water coming from? So you don't have to drag a long hose pipe, for example, to your garden to water them, or you don't have to spend tons on drip irrigation. So sunlight, water, accessibility, those are the three main things to consider before you set up your garden. And once you do that, that creates, you know, once you select your spot, then you have to create a garden design. And people often get confused between garden design and a planting plan. A garden design is the actual layout of your garden. So first thing is demarcate a border, that this is a space within which your garden is going to reside. And I think borders are so important, because all of us, you know, we all need a home, and the garden needs a home. And once you have that, then you set up your raised beds or in-ground garden, whatever you select, whatever you choose to do. You lay that out within that border or within that framework that you have, and then you create your planting plans as to what you're going to grow, which season you're in, things like that. So it's just very easy process. Select the right location, create a border or a framework within which your garden's going to reside. Within that framework, create a layout of your raised beds, and then the last step would be to create the planting plan as to what you're actually going to be filling your raised beds with, the crops.
I totally appreciate you, Resh, talking especially about that water access. I've learned that lesson several times over my gardening lifetime. And as a child, we had to haul water from home to our community garden. There was no access at that community garden where we were when I was a child, and that was the most thankless and, you know, onerous of the tasks that we had to do, was hauling bottled water from home and old milk jugs and things. And then in my current community garden, we have a cistern that's kind of at the top of a rise and sitting on a platform. So it's still hauling water by hand to your plots. And of course, those of us who are lucky to be close to the cistern have the least amount of work there.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't realize that. Kudos to you. That's a lot of hard work, I will say.
And you're always so grateful when it does rain and you don't have to hand water. But yeah, having a water source nearby and also being able just to keep an eye on it. So you talked about having it close by, like as many old-fashioned kitchen gardens were literally out the back door of the kitchen, because you would run back and forth to get your ingredients. While if it's, you know, a half acre away at the back part of your property, you're probably going to say, nah, I don't need that cilantro. I'll just have the tacos without it.
Exactly right. And there's also something to be said. I know my garden is right in my backyard. I wake up in the morning, first thing I do is peek out the window to just, look at it and see how it's doing. And gardening is also very therapeutic. So when it's close by, close to your home, easy to access, then you visit it often, in the mornings and the evenings, whenever you have the time, and you can just enjoy your time in the garden as well. So that's important.
And I think the secret of having a green thumb really is observation and spending time in the garden. That's the entire secret, everybody out there. It's just being able to see your garden and notice things. So if it's away, on the other side of a ridge or something, you're not going to do that. But if it's directly outside your window as you're washing your dishes, you're going to have much more success in that garden.
100% agree.
So we were talking about layout, getting to that stage. So once we found our sunny spot near hopefully a water source and not too far from our home, how would we figure out which way to lay it out? Is there importance of being north-south versus east-west for our beds?
So the beds, I guess the beds don't really matter. It doesn't matter with the beds whether they're north, south, or east, west. But what matters is if you're putting trellises, for example, arch trellises, and you're going to grow cucumbers, pole beans, things like that over it, you have to lay them out north, south, the trellises, just because the sun goes east to west. And so that's the way the shadows will be traveling throughout the day. So it's important to lay out your trellises north south because the raised beds, they could be square, they could be rectangular, they could be L-shaped. There's so many different options these days depending on your depending on your space. But with trellises and things, that grow vertically, it's important that they not cast a shadow on the rest of your plants. So my recommendation is that when installing trellises, especially arch trellises, make sure they are laid out north south and not east west. But listen, I guess nothing is perfect. If it's not possible, that shouldn't be the thing stopping you from gardening. You should still grow something and you should still try.
I agree. And I would say the same thing for some of those taller crops, like you talked about beans, but also if you were attempting corn or sunflowers, especially that mammoth sunflower, you wouldn't want that to shade the rest of your crops.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So those are, things to consider when you're growing. And actually, when we were talking about, I know we're talking about garden layouts right now, but this is something that I do like to discuss with my clients. And I have it in my book as well. In terms of the planting plants, because when you are actually planting things within the garden, the way I like to do it is follow the spiller, thriller, filler method, which I think a lot of people do that for flower gardens and containers as well. And it's a very popular methodology. So it's not like I've invented this terminology, but it's been out there for decades and centuries, perhaps. So right in the center of your beds or your raised beds, you want the tall plants. So it could be the corn or the cucumber growing on trellises or the pole beans or even your tomatoes, for example. Those have to be in the center of your raised beds. Then around them, rather in the corners of your raised beds, you want to do a lot of spillers, the things that flow over, such as trailing rosemary or petunias and pansies that can spill over your herbs as well. So they kind of create this softness about it. And in the middle for the fillers is what your medium-sized plants will go, such as your peppers, your eggplants, carrots, beetroot, things like that. So that's how I like to basically plan out my raised beds. The thrillers or the tall plants would be in the middle, then surrounded by the fillers or the medium-sized plants, and finally the soft trailing plants would and the herbs would be in the corners or the edges or the borders of the raised bed. Even your marigolds, which are really small, so that also helps with the shade and the shadow and the movement of the sun through your raised beds and your plants.
Yeah, it sounds like you like a pretty intensive growing plan. And I think instead of a row and then a foot between and then a row and a foot between, you're marrying your plants a lot closer than a lot of traditional gardeners might do.
Yes, I absolutely am a big advocate for intensive planting and mixing up the plants as well. Creating that style visually is not just attractive, but following the polyculture, which is basically not having rows and rows of just one vegetable growing in one raised bed, which is fine if that's easier for you to do. But I just feel when you mix up the plants and create a polyculture environment where there are a lot of different varieties of vegetables and fruits growing all together, it also, confuses the pests. And say, if something comes to attack your eggplants, like the flea beetles, they're not going to decimate all the crops of eggplants that you have growing in that one raised bed. But if you have cucumbers over there, you have peppers, or you have carrots, the flea beetles aren't going to attack it. So you're basically hedging your bet, so to speak. And you might win some, you might lose some, but at least you're going to get some harvest at the end of the day. So I like to plant intensively, and I also like to plant in a polyculture method versus a monoculture, which is traditionally what you see in farming, where you have rows and rows of just corn, for example, growing. And so you want to avoid that because of, like I said, for pests as well as for beauty.
Yeah, I would say looking through your book and the photos, I do the same. I'm a very intensive gardener and I just call it stuff it all in. And I would say also the photos look beautiful, the abundance and everything there. I mean, there is something to be said with neat little rows and being able to weed and water a little bit easier that way, but by the midsummer, it's all going to fill in anyway, even if you tried to start off very neat rows and everything.
Yeah, for sure. It's okay if you want to do it that way with neat rows and just grow your cabbages in one raised bed and your lettuce in another. That's fine because then you don't need to think so much about how you're going to design your raised bed and which plants are going to go in together. But there is something to be said about the way nature works. And I always like to think of it this way, how do you replicate nature as much as possible? And when you go to a forest, for example, you're not going to find just one type of tree. You're going to find the tall trees. You're going to find the shrubs, which are the medium trees. You're going to find some ground cover. There's going to be a variety. So you want to think of, replicating and mimicking nature as much as possible. Create that diverse polyculture environment. Add in flowers, pack in the plants, and just make it as beautiful and productive as possible. And I know sometimes I plant my tomatoes and all these vegetables in summer with the best of intentions. And if something fails, that's okay. Just have a few packets of seeds on hand. Go in there, direct sow something else in its place. And you never know. You might end up trying and growing something new, which you never knew was possible, and you might enjoy it. So that's my philosophy.
I think that is a great point. Yeah. And if plants fail, pull them out, right? So don't be so upset, if this year so such and such doesn't grow well for you. It's a learning lesson, right?
Yes, and every year, the weather, the temperature, the rainfall, all these things play a role in how a particular crop grows. So one year your tomatoes might grow amazingly well, and the next year it not be a tomato year for you, and it could be maybe for some other crop. So yes, you are 100% right. Not be upset. If something doesn't work out, it's a chance to try something new. And this is what I truly believe. That's the kind of mentality we should have in everything, that we should be open-minded, and failure is not the end of the world. It's just an opportunity to try something new.
And to make more compost.
Yes.
So, we got our layout done. We know we're kind of we're going to grow things and we're putting our raised beds maybe together. So you told a little bit about how it was maybe filled with topsoil and what you had to do to amend that. But what are you starting off if you were starting off brand new for your clients? What are you filling those raised beds with?
So when I'm starting out brand new with, for my clients, I know I have a soil recipe in my book, but basically what you want to do is you want to fill it with not just topsoil, because it depends on the depth of your beds. If you have just a 10-inch tall raised bed, for example, then you don't want to, fill it with too much topsoil because that doesn't have as much of nutrients as compost, but you do want to fill it with some kind of good organic potting soil. So basically, I like to fill my clients' raised beds with 30% topsoil, which is the filler material, 30% compost, which is the organic matter, and 10% of vermiculite, which helps fluff up the soil and helps with water retention as well. And I add about 5% of perlite, which helps with drainage for water. So once I add that in and mix everything in together into the raised bed, just the top 25% that's left, or the top 6 inches approximately, I would fill that with the best quality organic potting soil, like bag potting soil that I can find, which are meant for raised beds. And you plant your vegetables in that. And I found this to be successful year after year. And it's my fail-proof recipe, which is 30% topsoil, 30% compost, 10% vermiculite, 5% perlite, and then 25% just on top of the best quality organic bag potting soil that you can find.
And are you amending that every fall at the end of the season with new inputs, or how do you handle that?
So what happens is every year, obviously, as the seasons go by and the plants take the nutrients up from the soil, and also due to rain and snow, et cetera, the soil does compact over time a little bit, and you will notice the soil levels going down. So every fall, no matter what, I always add at least 4 inches of compost to my raised beds. And that kind of sets me up for success the following year in spring. Now, ideally, if you can, add compost to your raised beds, not just in fall, but also in spring, because adding the compost provides a source of food and nutrients to the soil biology, the fungi, and the microbes that are living under the soil, your earthworms, etc. So it gives them a source of food over the cold winter months. And as they eat it and they break down that material that's there in the broken down compost, but if they break it down even further, you're left with a really nutrient rich of soil come spring that's just ready for planting. So it makes it very easy. It's less work for you. So in fall, I always typically add at least 4 inches of compost on top of my raised beds. And I like to, mix it up. Like I said, polyculture, follow nature. And one of those things that I like to do is every year I try to add in different types of compost to my raised bed. So one year it could be mushroom compost, another year it could be leaf mold. Another year, it could be my homemade compost, but usually I do produce homemade. I have two composters at home, so I do produce a good amount of compost for my backyard garden. So I do add that in spring as well as in fall, even if it's, whatever little bit that I can generate, I always add that to my garden. So change it up, add some variety to your soil as well. Your plants will thank you.
I agree. I think switching up, if you're even buying store-bought things, switching up to different brands is also a good idea as well.
Yeah, I know. And when you read magazines, they tell you don't use the same shampoo, for a long time, change it up on skincare, things like that. So even with food, right? The diet that we eat, people say eat the rainbow. So it's why not for the soil? Why not add a variety of nutrients that you can? Because plants will absorb it and they'll re be really, really happy.
And so you talked about putting a border around your vegetable growing. Is that to keep out pests? I know it was to define the area, but what do you recommend for border material?
So it depends what your goal is. If you have deer and critters and things like that, then of course fencing is a must, because anything else, it's just not going to work. I know a lot of places they sell all those sprays and coyote urine and I don't know, all kinds of things, hot pepper sprays, et cetera, that you can spray around the border of your garden. But unfortunately, that is so risky and high maintenance, because anytime it rains, it just gets washed out and you can't just keep going back over and over again to keep spraying it. It's just too much work and it doesn't work. So if your goal is to keep out deer and critters, then fencing is a must. And especially for deer, I like to do at least, I would say minimum 6, but ideally, 7 to 8 foot, 7 foot tall fencing, so the deer can't jump over. And then if you don't have that issue, for example, with critters and pests, which most people do, in fact, then at least what you want to do is you need to have a border which could be made up of just, simple bricks. It could be stone, it could be metal edging, it could be what else? Any kind of, stones, things like that, just to define the area of your garden. So fencing, of course, defines your garden area, but so does all these other materials also.
And do you have any other tips for keeping pests out of the garden?
Another really important thing to do is when it comes to your raised beds, I do like to line the bottom of my raised beds with hardware cloth. The smaller the gauge or the smaller the opening of the wire that's there, the hardware cloth is a kind of a wire, galvanized steel mesh, so to speak. So you want to line the bottom of your raised bed, staple it to the bottom. So any kind of digging animals, voles, gophers, rats, they can't get in from the bottom. So that is an extra protective measure. And the plants that are most susceptible to critters are usually the baby seedlings, the ones, the seeds that have just been sown. So you could, if you wanted, put cloches on top of your little seedlings to protect them from rabbits and squirrels, etc. And of course, you can always add hoops and cover your raised beds, especially when they're smaller, just to protect them from the critters from digging in and, you know, eating up all your seeds.
Yeah, there's nothing more disheartening, right, than coming out and finding all your lettuces chewed down to the ground. But then you're like, well, I just grew a new generation of baby bunnies. So.
I know it's, you know, I have this love hate, not love hate. I have a hate relationship with the squirrels and chipmunks near my backyard. So I try to do my best to keep them away, but I do have a fence. Fencing is super important.
And so, for planning what you're going to actually grow, so I imagine some of your clients are single households, some people are couples or families. How do you determine how much to grow?
So you know what, how much someone should grow, it depends on also, it depends from client to client. I can't just say just grow four tomato plants, for example, for a family of two, because it depends, you know, what kind of varieties they want to grow, what is their goal. For example, some of them might really want the flavor of an heirloom tomato, and those are not as productive as, for example, a determinate tomato. So I'm a little bit hesitant to answer that as to how much you should grow, because it also depends on how much of something you like to eat. For example, someone might just love lettuce so much that they want to grow a whole 4 foot by 4 foot raised bed of lettuce. But at the end of the day, what's important to keep in mind is more than just determining exactly how many plants of each you want to grow for a family of two or family of four. It's important to stagger your plantings as well, especially for lettuces, radishes, carrots, and beetroot, because then you get a continuous harvest, you get a continuous production of food as well.
And when you say stagger, you don't just mean put them off center to one another in the rows. You're talking about succession planting.
Exactly right. I'm talking about succession planting, going in into your garden, planting 2 rows of lettuce, for example, then going in after another 10 days or 2 weeks and planting another 2 rows. And that same thing can be done with radishes, carrots, beetroot, other root vegetables, things like that. So leafy greens especially. So that is what I mean by staggering succession planting, because you don't want to have all your harvest, everything come in at once. And so same thing when it comes to tomatoes. Also, you want to create, you want 2 types of varieties, one which are the heirlooms, so you get the flavor, but you also want to do the determinate tomatoes, so you get the production, the ones that are hybrids or disease, they have some sort of disease resistance. So if one thing doesn't work out, you can still depend on something else, because nature has, you know, sometimes its own plans. Right, we can try and we can hope, but we can't always be sure.
And you used a vocabulary term there, determinate versus indeterminate tomatoes. Maybe we should define that for our listeners.
Sure. So determinate tomatoes are basically your bush variety, and most of the time behind the seed packet it will say determinate or semi-determinate. Also, if you go to your nursery or garden center, it might say DET for determinate, which is short. And those are tomatoes that grow a determined amount of fruit in a short period of time. So you will end up, when you grow determinate tomato varieties, you will end up with a flush of tomato harvest all within a span of maybe 1 to 1.5 months. Whereas if you grow indeterminate tomatoes, they will produce a little bit of fruit, but throughout the growing season of your 5, 6 months that you have between your last frost date and first frost date when your plants die, essentially. So indeterminate varieties are especially your cherry tomatoes, such as your Sun Golds, Super Sweet 100. A lot of your heirloom tomatoes are also indeterminate tomatoes. And the determinate tomatoes are, my favorite is Celebrity tomato. Galahad tomato is another one. And a lot of your saucing or canning tomatoes, such as your San Marzanos or your Amish paste, could be determinate or semi-determinate as well. So it's important to grow both so you get the production if you have goals of canning or preserving your harvest. And you have the flavor that you get from the heirloom varieties, such as the indeterminate tomatoes. And another thing to keep in mind is also with determinate tomatoes, because they produce a very determined or a, in a short period of time, a determined amount of fruit, you do not want to prune your determinate tomatoes. Whereas indeterminate tomatoes can grow really tall and large, like 7, 8, 10 feet tall. I've heard some people, their cherry tomato plants growing super duper tall. So when you have that, you want to prune indeterminate tomato varieties, but not prune your determinate tomatoes at all.
Good points. And yeah, so there's that also occurs with other types of vegetables. Like you could have determinate beans and indeterminate. So you'll see it say bush bean, meaning you get most of the harvest all at once within a week or two, right? For canning or something versus something that's going to produce all season long, but just a little bit all season long.
Correct, correct. And yeah, when you talk about bush beans too, that's another one that you can stagger your planting or do succession planting with beans. Because believe me, last year I planted a lot of beans, and yeah, I was tired of eating beans after a while.
Well, I'm going to ask you, I think, what is the hardest question for a lot of us vegetable gardeners, which is how do we know when to transition seasonally from one thing to another, maybe for going from the cool season to warm season and warm season into cool season? I find that most people do not want to pull out those tomatoes until the very last one has ripened.
So, it depends on the amount of space that you have. I can answer this very easily because I have a very small and limited growing space. So, you have to have a very, I know it's a heavy-hearted thing that you have to pull out your tomatoes, but it's important to also understand what are your goals as far as gardening is concerned. If you're okay with just growing summer crops, then it's fine. But generally, I would say, when you're transitioning, especially from summer to the fall, from spring to summer is not that much of a transition, but when you're transitioning from summer to fall, because your summer crops, yeah, like your tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, cucumbers, beans, melons, they will die with the first frost. And that's when temperatures, start going at freezing or around about freezing, and so they will die. However, the cool season crops really thrive at the cooler temperatures of between under 32 degrees, as well as up to 28 degrees, and some even like 24 degrees Fahrenheit, such as your kale, your Brussels sprouts, broccoli, etc. So it's important to understand a couple of things. One is when I'm transitioning my garden from summer to fall, then I do have to make that conscious decision that I know my tomato plants are going to be dying. They are full of blight, especially towards the end of summer. And I have to make the hard decision of pulling out my tomato plants, harvesting what I have, put your tomatoes in a brown paper bag, put a banana with it to help them ripen and turn from green to red, and then pick out all the debris and the fallen fruit, etc., that's there in your garden. Add some more compost if you can, add some bag potting mix, organic soil if you don't have access to compost, and then plant your cool season crops. Now, cool season crops, something like lettuce and radishes, they mature and grow really fast between 30 to 45 days. So if your frost date is, you can plant them about 30 days before your first frost, or even 1.5 months before your first frost, you can direct sow the seeds for lettuce and radishes. However, there are crops like your broccoli, and your brassicas, like cauliflower and cabbages, which do take 80 to 100 days to grow. So those have to be planted in the garden much earlier, at least 3 months before your first frost date. And also, one of the considerations to keep in mind as we transition from summer to fall and winter is that the sunlight hours are getting fewer and fewer and lower and lower. And second thing is the temperatures are getting colder and colder. So if something would thrive in that exact amount of time, say a carrot would grow in summer, typically in 60 to 75 days, that same carrot will take at least 2 to 4 weeks longer to grow in the colder months of fall and winter. But it will still thrive despite the frost. However, that's something to keep in mind that you need that extra time to grow your same vegetable if you're going to grow it in the fall. So when you're transitioning your garden from summer to fall, keep these considerations in mind and start planting in late summer. That is my biggest advice. And because the soil is already warm and it's a great conducive environment for direct sowing seeds. So if you still have your plants growing, your tomatoes growing, that's okay. Just add in some compost around it and direct sow seeds for bok choy, for kale, for lettuce, arugula, radishes, beets, carrots. Direct sow the seeds because that will also, this warm soil will speed up the germination greatly. So you don't have to, worry so much about starting seedlings indoors and then putting them outside, except of course if it's for those larger plants, your brassicas, which you want to, typically I would plant my brassicas in late June, early July for a fall harvest.
Yeah, that seems just so early for a fall
I
crop,
know.
but yeah, we're not thinking about it then, but we really need to put that on our schedule. And such
Yes.
great points, and thank you for sharing all that garden wisdom. I can see why your book is called Vegetable Gardening Made Easy. You broke it down so well for us, Resh. And how can our listeners get in contact with you if they want to find out more?
So the best place to find me would be on my social media on Instagram. My handle is at Resh Gala, which is ReshGala. And I share a lot of my gardening tips and tricks. And if you need to reach me, you send me a DM over there and stop by and say hello. And apart from that, you can find me also on my website, www.reshgala.com. That's again ReshGala. And I do have an email as well mentioned there in case you need to reach me. But yeah, my social media, my Instagram, and my website are probably the best ways to get in touch with me.
Terrific. Any final advice for those beginning vegetable gardeners out there?
Yes, my best advice that I can give all of you is just to get started. Don't overthink it. There are enough complicated things out there in the world that when it comes to gardening, it should be fun. It should be exciting and it's okay to make mistakes. But most importantly, you have to just go out there, plant something, learn from it, and just do it and just get started.
Thank you so much, Raish.
Thank you so much for having me, Kathy. Appreciate it.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Oxalis plant profile. Oxalis is the largest genus in the family Oxalidaceae, with over 550 species native to every continent except Antarctica. They are often referred to as wood sorrels and as false shamrocks. Some Oxalis species can be grown as annuals or perennials, depending on your climate and zone. Note that in some regions, Oxalis are considered invasive. Oxalis triangularis, is commonly grown as a houseplant and gifted on St. Patrick's Day because its foliage resembles the lucky shamrock. The Oxalis's clover-like foliage can be variegated or solid green or burgundy. In addition to its attractive leaves, the plant has delicate flowers. It will often go winter dormant and then recover when placed in sunlight. Give it an all-purpose houseplant fertilizer about once a month. It prefers to grow in bright indirect or direct light and temperatures between 65 to 85 degrees Fahrenheit never below 60 degrees. Water it once a week and let it dry out partway between waterings. The most common cause of yellow leaves is overwatering, which causes root rot. Oxalis is considered toxic for pets due to its oxalic acid that can cause kidney damage. Some oxalis are called butterfly shamrock because their leaves fold up at night or on cloudy days and then reopen when the sun shines. They may also stretch out their leaves to reach as much sunlight as possible. Oxalis, you can grow that. What's new in the garden this week? Well, I'm noticing several shrubs coming into bloom in my garden, including Pyrus japonica, forsythia, and the PJM rhododendrons. In our Garden Tip of the Day post on our social media, we share the science of phenology, or seasonal indicators, this week. They tell us that when the maple trees begin to leaf out, perennials can be planted. And dandelion blooms mean it's time for planting potatoes. In local gardening events, the Mid-Atlantic region is hosting the 70th anniversary American Daffodil Society's convention from April 10th to 13th at the Hyatt Regency Dulles in Herndon, Virginia. That can be attended free of charge by the public during certain hours, and that's Thursday, April 11th, 2 to 7 p.m., and Friday, April 12th, from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. You can see the competitions in horticulture, design, and photography. You can find out more about that at daffodilusa.org. And Ikebana International, the Washington, D.C.'s chapter number one, is hosting its annual exhibition at the U.S. National Arboretum in Washington, D.C. on April 12th through 21st. This exhibition will demonstrate the creativity and artistry of their members' arrangements, representing several different schools of Ikebana. So you can attend that for free and see live demonstrations showcasing different schools. And the exhibition and live demonstrations are all free and open to the public, as I said, including Ikebana for Kids workshop on April 21st, which does require prior registration. And then at Mount Vernon in Alexandria, Virginia, they are having their historic plant and garden sale the weekend of Friday, April 26th and Saturday, April 27th. The Friday hours of noon to 6 are for members only, and then the general public can come on Saturday, April 27th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and shop for heirloom vegetables, herbs, annual flowers, native perennials, trees, and shrubs, many of them grown in Mount Vernon's greenhouses. And so they are credit card only, no cash. So be sure to attend that, and you can find out more at the Mount Vernon website. Happy gardening!
In the new book, The Urban Garden, by Kathy Jensen Terry Spade, you'll find dozens of inspiring and creative ways to grow flowers, shrubs, vegetables, herbs, and other plants in small spaces and with a limited budget. Whether you want to grow on a balcony, rooftop, front stoop, or a tiny urban patio, turn your growing dreams into reality and build a gorgeous and unique garden that showcases your personal style while still being functional and productive. With the ingenious ideas and resourceful tactics found here, you'll be maximizing yields and beauty from every square inch of your space while also making a lush outdoor living area you'll crave spending time in. Whether you're growing edible plants or beautiful flowers, the 101 amazing growing ideas found in the urban garden will turn your tiny urban yard into a treasure trove of green you'll be proud to share with family and friends. Buy your copy today at your local retail bookseller or order it online now at amazon.com or bookshop.org. Get low-maintenance alternative to lawns with the new book Ground Cover Revolution by Kathy Jens. Reducing the lawn is among the biggest trends in homeownership, with an endless stream of homeowners looking for an eco-friendly alternative to a traditional, everyday grass lawn. In the last few years alone, over 23 million American adults converted part of the lawn to a natural landscape, and now are looking to do even more. The biggest challenge to adopting this new ideal of the perfect lawn is knowing how and when to replace your turf and which plants are the best ones for the job. Ground Cover Revolution is here with all the answers you need. Included are 40 in-depth profiles of plants that are perfect choices for replacing a grass lawn. There are options for sun, for shade, for dry and wet sites, and for various climates around the globe. There are choices that bloom, options that are evergreen, and selections that are deer resistant. Author Kathy Jentz has also included an incredibly useful chart that gives you all the details on each of the 40 choices for quick reference and to make your ground cover selection process even easier. Whether you want to replace the entire lawn or just reduce the amount of land dedicated to turf, Ground Cover Revolution will help you usher in a new and improved idea of what a beautiful lawn should be. Available at bookstores now and also at Quarto.com, where you can get 30% off using discount code GARDENING30.
This is The Last Word by Christy Page at Food Gardening on My Failing Peach Tree. Today is a sad day. The peach tree that we so lovingly planted the first spring after buying our home is declining. All of the love and attention that we are showering on it does not seem to be helping. How do we know when it's time to say goodbye? Penelope, the peach tree, is so very dear to us. For years, I had wanted a fruit tree. Our previous house had an itty-bitty yard, and after the swing set and the dog play area, there just wasn't enough room for any fruit trees. Each spring, I would gaze at the rows of fruit trees at the nearby nursery with longing. I would walk by slowly, imagining them flowering in my yard and giving us fruit all summer long. Yet, each year, I needed to pass by them, knowing that I did not have room for them to flourish. That all changed when we bought the house with the bigger yard. Now, with over an acre of land, I had the space to plant all the berries, fruit trees, and vegetables I dreamed of. That very first spring, my husband brought me to the nursery for my birthday and told me to pick out my fruit tree. I gravitated right towards the peaches. I could already envision where it would go and how it would be enjoyed for years to come. We purchased the most delightful peach tree, which I instantly named Penelope. We brought her home and found the perfect spot with lots of sun, making her a comfy area of the yard. She was planted with plenty of fertilizer, a cute border, and a layer of mulch. For years, we lovingly tended to her, and she rewarded us with the sweetest of fruits. A couple of weeks ago, we had a horrible storm. Snow, ice, and wind whipped through our yard and battered us all night long. When I awoke in the morning, I noticed that a tree from back in the woods had snapped off a large branch and was now across the yard. On further inspection, I could tell that it managed to damage Penelope on its way down. Several branches were battered and broken. Several more may have been damaged by the wind and ice alone. We spent that day cleaning up the yard and gently pruning back the damage on Penelope. Some branches were so badly broken that they had to be taken off entirely. I was hurting inside to see the destruction of a tree that had been so good to us for years. She looked so sad and bare without her missing limbs. I'm holding on to hope that when spring arrives, her remaining branches will flourish and survive. I'm anxious to see the first budding flowers that, to me, are the true sign that spring is upon us. I'm being cautious, though, and thinking that I may need to prepare myself for a trip to the nursery and another fruit tree. Perhaps she needs a friend. Or we should just get one anyway. Maybe we can name him Peter. This has been The Last Word on My Failing Peach Tree by Christy Page at foodgardening.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/GardenDC. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.blogspot.com. Thank you. You can find and follow Washington Gardener on Twitter/X, Instagram, and Pinterest at WDC Gardener, and on Facebook at Washington Gardener Magazine. Please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on Spotify and Apple. Open the Spotify or Apple app, search for Garden DC, check on the rate button, and select 5 stars.